Side 2. Thursday, December 6, 1956. Reel number 19.
Obviously, in the New Testament, when the Apostle Paul speaks of the, we have on this earth no permanent stead, but the eternal we are looking for, the future we're looking for. He who had gone to a place like Dartmouth College in Tarsus, of course, tried to inherit or to supersede this Platonic utopia. We all live in the same predicament. At this moment, we are American citizens, and we know very well that God did not create America directly. He created man, and certain, obviously the destiny of man is not to be American, gentlemen. It's to be a man. And therefore, we have to admit that we are in a temporary stage of the affairs of the world, whether we like it or not. This is the eternal question of philosophy. This you have to, therefore, to use. My tools which I have offered you are the three tools of Logos, Ethos, and Physis. And therefore, these are the two demands made on you to use these tools so that you can make understandable the drive behind any one of these goods. These are not luxuries. These are attempts which you all make, knowingly or unknowingly. The other day, men came back from Cairo, Egypt, and said to me, most American businessmen are Muslim. They think they are Christians, but in fact, Muslim is the most simple religion for men. It, of course, doesn't take care of the women. Women have no place in Muslim life. But the American businessman, if he isn't under the thumb of his wife at home and escapes into the business district and to Rotary clubs, he and Dartmouth colleges, where no women, where no women are admitted, he immediately arranges a world of mind which is very simple, the mixture of Muslim, Islam, and Stoicism. Most of you are Stoics, gentlemen. In America, you find practically no Epicureans. Everybody is here Stoicist, and or an idealist, or what he thinks a materialist. Epicureans are, you find them in France. That's an Epicurean country. The hope of the world is that the French Epicureans and the American Muslims get together. Both are horrid in their insulation. They have no government, and the Americans have no mind. They go from one craze to another here. Yeah, because they have not the center of the inner beatitudes, which is the gospel of Epicurus. You see that the city of man, politics, should not influence your salvation. Well, in any case, there are minimum demands, a representation of what these people really were doing with the tools of Logos, Ethos, and Physis as the eternal reason for philosophy. And I would take it as a complete bankruptcy of your paper if you would not give to me to understand that you understand why philosophy is in every grown-up person a necessity. He cannot escape it. Philosophy is not a course you can take, gentlemen, as you can take zoology, you see, or leave it, or chemistry. It is, you philosophers either poorly or you philosophize well. But whether you like, most of you will philosophize in imitation of some overhanging prejudice which is in the air of your time. More I cannot say, because every one of you, of course, is left to his own devices to go to his, to these philosophers himself. I will, may add, however, today, one more problem. Yes, last time, as you know, I tried to clear you up on the ethics, and I tried to make you understand that in ethics we deal not with a naturalistic code, and that you are here that ethics is a course which you can take in a school as you can take mathematics, is of the devil. It's the Anglo-Saxon diabolical temptation to think that the rules of behavior, moral behavior, can be learned by heart as you can learn the penal code or as you can learn the families of phylloptera or of lizards. In the city of men, gentlemen, this is the Latin word civitas, and this is the Greek word, and here I put the Greek word and that's the Latin word. You see, and the Anglo-Saxon word in this case would be world, and in this case we have no English word for the political entity, because the tribes were Christianized so early that we say at best city, you see, or state. These are all words of Latin origin. There is no Anglo-Saxon term for the community. I don't know of any. Do you know of any? Community is Latin. You see, it comes from communis in Latin. So it's very strange. Anglo-Saxons have no native term for the political order. Yeah? What? If you feel that it works, oh, I'm very nice. Very nice. Yes, people, you see, it doesn't work because it comes from populus, Latin, again. So tongue. Well, thank you. Do you know the root of tongue? Not sure, but I think it is
French.
It's not German at all, it's perhaps Celtic. I'm not sure.
It's not French.
No, it's not French. But the ending D-U-N, you know, in auteur and so, that may be contained in it. You see, that's the Celtic ending. Most in Gaul, under Caesar, most cities ended in dunum, with the ending dunum. And I don't know if town has anything to do with that.
I think it was originally ton, supposed to use the T-U-N, which is a division of a hundred, which is a division of a shire in England.
Well, in any case, it's useful. Let's use it. Town. You can say ten. And it's quite important because in this connection I cannot deal with it explicitly, but you may take this down as a rule, gentlemen. Any word in our civilized language, in French, German, English, Italian, has three forms, Greek, Latin, and native. And it is only digested when you have it in all three forms. That's very strange. Why that is so, it's a long story. I've written a whole book on this topic, that to digest a process in the world outside, it takes a native approach, which is the homely one, you see, the familiar one, the lowbrow one, and it takes the highbrow, the religious one, which comes from the Christian church through the ages, usually in Latin, like nature, and then we found a special science like physics, and then we use the Greek term. So the theologian speaks of natura, nature, you see. We speak of the world in our native tongue, and the specialist speaks of physics or physiology, and so he makes out of this natura something Greek. Well, that leads you so far, but only to make you feel that it isn't quite wanting if I draw your attention to the fact that there are three terms for the same thing under a different aspect. When you philosophize, you use the Greek term. When you theologize, you use the Latin term. When you speak idiomatically at home, you use the Anglo-Saxon term. That's a good rule for you, you see. The religious language has come to us as Latin. We say religion, religio, you see. But if you have the Greek term theology, you see, you are in the learned bracket of the divinity school. Theology is Greek. You have this strange relation, you see. Here's religio, Latin. The Greeks had quite a different word for that. Now to come back, however, to the main problem today. The main problem today is the question of the appearance of the logos with regard to things and the appearance of the logos between people. I try to show you that ethics comes to people through action. You know what a man is morally worth, not from what he says, because he can be a hypocrite. And most people are hypocrites because they have some standardized ethical phrase in their mouth, and I don't care in the least what they say. Many will say, Lord, Lord, and will go to hell. But you have to see what the man is doing. And I've tried to give you some examples last time of what ethical action is. The creation of a free, non-natural situation, gentlemen, that's ethical. If you treat your neighbor as a new person every day and find yourself free to change with regard for him, you see, then he's free. In my Christian Future, I've expressed it in a simple way. God rethinks his creation every day in the light of the fate of his children. And when we make terrible mistakes, he allows us to find a new way. That's called the remission of sins. And after your parents have seen that you can't go to college, for example, they allow you to become a carpenter because they rethink their prejudices, the world, from love of you. The same is done by God. Our Creator always has still a way out. Here we haven't made peace for 10 years, but that doesn't mean that he will not perhaps find a way in which he will allow us to come to terms with the world. At this moment, that's in the making, as you know, in the most circumstantial way, with landing in Suez and such things. We are finally forced into taking seriously the fact that we must make peace. We never have made peace. So, will you take this down, gentlemen, that the world in the respect of ethics of our town has to be rethought every day because of the mistakes men makes. And how could you ever mend the mistakes if our Maker would not then give us new opportunities? So because we do not do as our Father in Heaven likes us to do, he has to rethink his creation. Otherwise there could be no government of the world. Then rethinking, gentlemen, is the essence of the Logos. The Logos is more free state than you and he. We are handicapped by our mistakes. Today, the mistakes made in our foreign policy cry to heaven. If heaven responds, it means that he allows us once more to start, although we have made these mistakes, but they haven't been legal, so to speak. There's still a time of grace given to us. But the plan of God obviously was not to do the things. You just look at the Orozco frescoes when God each time throws up his hands in despair and says, this world has to come to an end. It's just impossible. Three times in these frescoes, God, you see, says, finish. But there's a new start. And you wonder how long it can go on, how long he can find a new way of letting this continent be peopled by idiots. Now, gentlemen, the Logos is the power with which we speak to each other, and it is the power with which we come to know the universe, the objects. And these are two different ways, and I want to tell you how to understand this, the eternal conflict between my dealing with the forest or the stars and my dealing with you. The star I must first see. That is, the first thing is an impression made on me by through my senses. Preferably the sight, the eye, but I can also hear a sound. I can smell a flower. I can touch a stone. Therefore, gentlemen, the first impressions of the physis go through the senses. Now, the materialist says to you, all first impressions go through the senses. However, gentlemen, I tell you, and I remind you of the fact, your first impressions as a baby in the cradle do not go to your five senses at all. They go through your parents' words and their manners. That if you are sat down at a dinner table and see suddenly that you don't have to grab for food, but it's coming to you, that your mother distributes it, you lose all animal fear that you might be curtailed in your dealings. Think that this is not natural for an animal. An animal, if you have five chickens and you feed them, all the chickens, as you well know, try to get the food at the same time. It's not possible to stop the other four, you see, because they have experience that they all get something. They will not wait. We do. That is, gentlemen, we can understand in the city, our first impressions come through meaning. It makes sense to us that our mother should treat our father, our five children as equals, and should therefore not, you see, acquire their fears, and they immediately understand that the mother is in charge and that they don't have to watch out for themselves, somebody else does. Now, therefore, our first impressions here come through sense. It makes sense to us. And we are told this. That is, our first impression in the city comes through speech and through being addressed. Now, you do not deal with stones by addressing them. That's witchcraft. It doesn't work by magic. Stones have to be lifted out of the way or you will stumble over them. The five senses tell us what to do with things, gentlemen. First impression of things go through the senses. But first impression of people, gentlemen, they go through functions, they go through speech. Because you have hear from your mother that you are Johnny and she is your mother, you distribute the universe outside between your mother and you. What you can, she cannot, you cannot do, she will do. And so you disarm. All speech, gentlemen, leads to disarmament. And all sensuous experience leads to armament. That's why the term moral disarmament is an idiotic term of the core group, of the Bookmanites, of the Oxford group. It is not. You have to disarm between people, not arm.
What do you mean by disarming?
Well, you are disarming, sir. So that's why we can talk to each other. You will now at this moment confess that you do not understand me. That's a disarming question. A blusterer, a vain person, would say, I know everything, you can't have any enemy. That's the relation of object and object in the universe. They try to remain impenetrable, they try to defend each other. If I try to behave as an individual, you see, and you as an individual, you can never understand each other. It takes always an amount of humility, of disarmament, in the sense. That you can get under my skin and I under your skin, otherwise you couldn't talk to me. You must accept my word as a part of your truth. And I must accept your word as a part of my truth. You understand? This osmosis is the condition of speech. Because every speech you remember takes the needs of the listener as well as the speaker. And speech is only complete if a speaker has made another person listen. Therefore, since the listening process is part of the word, speech, you see, we can only get together by the element. We take two suspicious people, take now the Russians, and we cannot speak to each other because we always find a material motive. Why does it get this arm? Therefore, we can talk and talk and talk, and every word gets misinterpreted. This is very serious, gentlemen. So nature is armed to the teeth. And man is, in the city, disarmed. In your naivete, you have a kidnapper, and you go to the telephone and telephone the police because you trust the police. They come in armed to the teeth, but they won't use the arms against you. So, because you trust them. You can also say it's a mutual trust leads to disarmament. However you put it, it's literally true that frigid women, that's a problem for all of you, you see, cannot disarm. Frigidity is the impotency of disarming. They have their willpower always in, they want to dominate, and this frigid woman cannot love, because love is disarmament.
We learn that the sense is true, as you said, our parents, we learn that thing, we learn to say, now this is a stone, this is a book, this is a light.
Well, that's pitiful. Object of nature you should learn by effect, by sense. It would be better if you first experience the object, you see, the object of the world through your five senses.
Yes, but the point is that we learn to name them through speech, and speech is a disarming process. Therefore, through speech are we not disarming?
Yes, but you don't talk to the stone. Be a stone. That you say to your mother, this is a stone because you trust your mother. she has put this idea that this is a stone into you and you accept it. So she can get under your skin and enrich your whole inner life, because what she has, you see, is like an ocean penetrating your shore, your dry shore, you see. The flood of the spirit is then welling up in her and in you. She has, of course, accepted this on good faith. And she imparts it to you. It's like waves of the spirit moving through you and her. Or like waves compared to this. That's what the mind is. The mind is the community of people, you see, taking place in every newborn citizen, entering them.
Well, why should we learn about the business through our senses from the first place? And since we need this, meaning from the spirit also.
Well, because the meaning, of course, of the that world outside the physical world can only be complete if it includes the fact that the stone is something that must be known by contact. I name rock, a cliff, a mountain, something that I can only learn in its condensed density.
This is just my education then. I'm not really applying to anything except just the fact that this becomes real to me is when I touch it, not until I touch it. And,
yeah, well, I don't quite see your argument. I would like to understand that.
I'm a little confused myself, but this business of having to experience the business through the senses is really only for the sake of education, more than any.
And if they know misunderstanding, you only get the word. You must understand. The mother has experienced the stone and knows what is called stone. If you only learn by what the term stone, you might apply it to something that isn't a stone. Well, gentlemen, you learn that in all philosophy today, which is all only natural philosophy in this country mostly, and not at all moved by considerations of the ethos and the logos, it's all a glorified physicist philosophy. You learn that first something is in the senses and later it's in the concept. That is, the thing is, here is a blackboard. Now you try to form a concept of a blackboard. First you see it, and then you may even grab it with your hand and feel its consistency, and then you say, I call this a table. And you call this, define your term. And you are very proud when the speaker gets up and says, I shall first define my term. Gentlemen, that's only reasonable with regard to objects. Terms can only be defined before speech with regard to physical objects. Take this down very important. You don't believe it. It is perfectly hopeless for a man who speaks with somebody else to define his terms. You cannot say, you see, sir, I consider you a gentleman as far as it goes in my terminology, because I know gentlemen who are scoundrels. If you say gentleman, you must mean it. Otherwise, you're lost. And so on it goes. With every word you say to any audience, by addressing them, you cannot insult them by defining their terms and say, as far as it goes, or you don't know what I mean. I mean, then they will say, he calls us gentlemen, but he means we are scoundrels. That's innuendo. You can only define objects which are neither the speaker nor the listener. The speaker and the listener must always trust each other. And if you define the terms of your listener in any of your own terms, you insert it. You insert it. You cannot define your listeners as, well, these are Americans, therefore they don't have the intelligence of Frenchmen, therefore they don't have the beauty of Italians, they don't have the grandeur of Spaniards. My dear man, this American from New Mexico will get up and say, I have as much Spanish grandeur and as much Italian singing capacity and any man in Italy. I have just made a point to develop my human qualities beyond what you range of what you call 100% Americanism. Gentlemen, you have always this tripartite situation. You speak to somebody about something. You can define something. You can never define somebody. Somebody to you must be
as mysterious and as dangerous as your wife. Don't define your wife. If you do, you're divorced.
That the logos words, the essence of logos words, rethinking. You said it's Plato's logos. Is that the essence of Plato's logos? Rethinking?
No, he's Plato, born by this memory out here. That's his flaw. But that's why he finally avoided the word logos. He had nous for the brain and he had the ideas. That's not the same as logos. The ideas don't talk. They don't speak. This, the weak point of all Greek philosophy is the idea that speech, you see, was something natural, like an object. If you want to know more about it, read the Kratylos, the poorest dialogue of Plato's on language. And you can readily understand by reading it that he just didn't succeed in knowing what language was. Modern linguistics can do absolutely nothing with the Greek standpoint on language. I mean, it's just dropped today. It's superseded. Here. Gentlemen, all speech between real people, between the speaker and the listener, of any description, mother and child, father and brother, soldier and captain, counselor and mayor, judge and police, wherever you have social relations in a community, whatever the relation be, boss and worker, slave and slave owner, whatever it is, where there are human relations, what they call today human relations, the way is from reciprocal address, gentlemen, from reciprocal address to rescue the other from loneliness and despair. To agreement. The way from here is from the senses to the concept. You must take this down here, and you find this unfortunately in no textbook, because as I said, all Americans are quite one-sided conceptualists. They believe in concepts as the only way of human understanding. They think that if you have a concept for a thing, you haven't understood it. Now, my dear man, you understand very well the United States. But you will never have a concept of the United States. You must live it. There's no way. You must be part of it. You can say, gentlemen, the community or the town to our town of Wilder, of Mr. Yeah, Wilder is his name, isn't it? Thornton Wilder. You know this. Who knows our town? Good. Well. Well, that's an excellent, you see, today the unfortunate thing is that the best things are only in literature, in poetry or plays and not in philosophy. Thornton Wilder is an essential contribution to the philosophy of reality, you see, because our town means that the people in this town are not objects for each other, and that's why we call it our town. Wherever you have the word our, you see, all philosophy about things stops. There are no things. They are only brothers, this happy band of brothers, as in Shakespeare's famous prologue of the, isn't that Henry V? So, where is this happy, see? What? Don't you know it? Well, our town is a similar attempt to bring you to your senses that between people in a town, in our town, there are no objects which we can define. Not one of the persons in the town can define the other person because they talk to each other. Will you take this down, gentlemen? People to whom we talk or whom we want to talk to us cannot be defined because we are expecting them to say something beyond their definition. In as far as you can define a person, you know already what he has said. But since you meet him on the street, you hope you will say to him a friendly word. Now, you deliver on the street yesterday. You meet a neighbor on the street, he said that was a fine speech. If you could define a man in beforehand, the value of his utterance would be nil, because he would just be a machine object. And so out like an automation, there would come, he would stutter out these empty phrases. It was a nice speech. You mean, however, when you hear this about yourself, that it was really a fine speech.
and you can only believe this one sentence if this is in addition to everything you have known by it before. If it comes as a wonderful surprise that even this old fox now says something nice about you. You will not evaluate at all his praise if you treat him as a dead man, and if you say, oh, he says this to everybody, then you would already dismiss his words, you see, as not really living words. And there are, of course, such people who use these soft phrases, but we despise them. We say they have died, you see, long ago. They only can repeat these empty phrases. They are either hypocrites or they are, you see, gone to sea. So you see, the more a person is alive, the more it is impossible and harmful for him to try to define it. You cannot elect the President of the United States for everything he has done before. You must expect from him that he will do something that you couldn't do. That's therefore something beyond your comprehension. Therefore, as aware, anybody with whom you live must remain beyond your comprehension, because otherwise it wouldn't be worth living with him. The difference, gentlemen, between the wife of the president of a corporation and his workers is that from the workers he expects things he knows very well and what they consist, because he gives them a labor charge, we expect them to do exactly what he prescribes. But his wife, he cannot mail that prescription. He cannot put on a chart, my dear wife, I expect orange juice every morning. Because the first thing his wife will do that he will tear up this recipe and go up to the Gandhi. Because he can't stand it. She is not willing to be lived with by prescription. She's surprised every morning. So please, the greatest heresy is all in all your mind, that it is meritorious to begin a speech by saying, I have tried to find my children. On no important thing can you do anything but speak English. And English is much richer than the definition which you can give any term. You just look up the dictionary. Every word is a poetical word and has 10,000 shades of meaning, and it is your business to use the word so that the other person gets all the shades of meaning which you wish to stress. It's no business of yours to define it beforehand. That's making the speech all fine. But it is deep in you, gentlemen, and that's why you are very unhappy people. You are fed up. You are slaves of your concepts, because you carry over the idea of conceptual living into marriage, into friendship, into politics, where they don't belong. And the Catholic Church, I think, is right that it thinks that in marriage, this whole business of conception and anti-conception is of the central order of your relation to the spirit. If a man thinks that he can live by conception, concept, he will also think that he can prescribe when to have a child. I don't believe that. That's not within you or my power. That's also defining your terms, the terms under which you wish to live, gentlemen. You can have this in certain limited things as an hour of work. I don't think that in your marriage relations you can do this without running the danger that when a child is born just the same, to treat this child as a mere mischief. It isn't. The child that is born without plan is certainly more your child than the plan that is born under according to plan.
It's obvious. It fulfills much more the purpose of marriage, that we should be self-forgetful there. We should be allowed to forget ourselves and all our plans. That's the meaning of marriage, the plunge.
These are very serious things, gentlemen. It all centers around the word concept. If a man is thinking that he always must define his terms, he may be a lawyer, a good lawyer, because what is a lawyer? A lawyer is a man who treats part of the community, the other party in law, as nature, as an object, whom he wants to conquer, to win. Therefore, a lawyer must speak in concept, in the town, inside the town. But if you go to talk while today, the town crier and the men on the cemetery there, and as I recall, they don't talk legally. Gentlemen, to speak legally means to speak
inside the city in concepts. And concepts are for objects, or things against which we must arm. And you can see the lawyer is morally armed inside the city. There is a break of law, there's a criminal, there's a complaint, there's a defendant. You see, there's accusation, there's a condemnation, there is a demand, there's a claim. For all these things, you need concepts. Because one goes against the other. Where we stand against the world, we need concepts. Because we want to define our terms against the world and against people whom we treat as world. The lawyer must treat his opponent as a part of the outside world and knows, you see, nothing but that this other man may abuse him. Therefore, he must arm to the teeth. His legal brief is armed to the teeth. So conceptual that you can't understand it. So, gentlemen, the road of the nature is through the senses to the concept. Please. The road of nature is through the senses to a concept. The road of the community is through reciprocity to agreement. Because if the mother says son and the son says mother, they can agree. If the son says, you are not my mother, there's enmity. She's an object of psychoanalysis. Very important, gentlemen. As long as you give the other fellow in the community the name he wants to be addressed with, and he grants you your name, you see, you are in at peace, you are in agreement. So, gentlemen, the communal logos is mutual address. The physis logos of for the nature is not mutual address, but conceptual interpretation of sense reaction. Something totally different. I cannot understand you, and you cannot understand me by any concept, you see. You're just Donald Francois. Stop it. Period. As soon as I go behind you and begin to analyze you, you become an object, you see. And we are estranged. Because you must be afraid of me. I mean now, you see, like the Nazis or the fascists or the communists, I mean now look for all your weaknesses and I may try to exploit them, you see. I may play on any one of your, you see, objective natural qualities and we have ceased to trust each other. If you only could learn this, gentlemen, it would be the great boon for the birth of philosophy in this country. There is no American philosophy today. It doesn't exist. Because people have made the logos one-sidedly nothing but the definition of terms. That's only one half of the story. All the semanticists do this nonsense, you see. But you always ask them, how can they express what they do if they don't speak anymore? Speech is mutual before it is definable. All these people must first learn poetry and prayer and song and drama and literature before they can then legally, suspiciously, you see, put those things that are pure objects of sense observation into their place. Why do we have to deal with nature by concept, gentlemen? By the simple reason that the natural objects cannot talk back. But you can talk back. Your response is correct if you feel addressed, if this has an appeal on you. If I can say to this man, Richard, and he comes, that's all we can want, then my word is Richard, his name, is a better word than any concept I have of the man. Because the concept of the man is not between you, him and me, it's just in my mind. That's worth anything. But his name is something I use and he complies with. Gentlemen, that's very fundamental. And you see, the logos then is broken up into two highways on which it travels. The logos travels through names of mutual and reciprocal validity into the human community, into our town. And it travels with regard to the chemicals and the elements of the universe on the wings of concepts. If you take an atom, if you take a Faraday, if you take a volt, if you take an ohm, if you take all the terms of our modern physics, they, as you know, are defined terms by the Congress of Physicists every year. And you have ampere. You know what an ampere is. You know volt. Well, who is volt? What is volt? That's just the name of the men who discovered, you see, volts, voltage. And what was his name? Volta, an Italian, yes. And ampere was a Frenchman, you see. And Gauss was a German, and on it goes. So there are, you have clear definitions. Why? Only for the sad fact that atoms cannot talk. They cannot respond when we name them. I have a friend at Harvard in the political government department who wanted harps on this simple fact that he says the natural scientist is much worse off than we. We can talk to the people, and by their response they say if they have understood. But these poor people have to weigh the thing, the treasure, because they have no way ever to know whether the bull is satisfied. They can never get the vote of the things in nature. This is true. I have tried all the time to tell you that the real history of philosophy is from the city into the world. And you are all obsessed by the devil because you think that nature is first and men is second, and society is second. Communism, Marx, for example, is on my side. He rediscovered the Platonic truth that the city is before the nature in our lives. That we first must talk to each other before we can deal with certain things.
When Plato mentioned that when he was developing his city and the republic, men got together in the city because they needed food and physical comfort. So I was wondering if he wasn't intimating in that sentence.
Although the real story is that the Greek city first, and in Plato is already this lack of linguistic understanding. You see, all Greek philosophy is hampered by the fact that they say speech is natural, and I say speech is political, all speech is ethical. And as long as you say speech is natural, then it is a tool of any individual's will. But it is reciprocal. Any word of the human language is based on the assumption that I must say father so that he may say son. Don't you see that as if I, the word father, has made any sense? It is only on the basis of the fact that somebody is the son. This we have lost sight of because we are dealing with said objects. You see, in our town, my father must speak to his son. In general, however, in nature, there are chickens who have, you see, the rooster as their vigilant. So it is not, the rooster cannot say my children. We can say my child because we speak. This word, my and our and your, you see, is the difference of ethics and physics. In physics, gentlemen, there are no possessive pronouns. There are no secrets. There are no inner and outer, you see, worlds, but there's only the outer world. Physics only deals with an outer world, and in the outer world there are no possessive pronouns. And nothing in the outer world has any name to itself. Therefore, ohm, volt describes things by human names because these are nameless electronics. They have no names of their own. Arbitrary, they can't understand it. We domesticate animals and then give them names from our inside our own community to attract them to our town, into our town. If you take our town by Mr. Thornton Wilder seriously, and if you stop smoking, then you will understand that our town underlies opposite rules from nature. In nature, you can always smoke because the tree will not come protest. I protest. Now, gentlemen, the logarithm comes to us through concepts and names. And both processes are equally original. And you don't believe this. And this is why this country for the last 150 years has not seen thinking, straight thinking. Because it has not observed the facts of life. In a pioneer country where one man had to brace himself against the Rocky Mountains, you may easily understand that nature was so overwhelmingly strong that you saw the object in nature, you see, as the only thing that needed explanation. Do you understand? Men went out so much on their own, they were so lonely, that they thought if they had a picture of, you see, of the outer world, of the cosmos and the physics, that was all that mattered. And the city of men, so to speak, came after that. We must now turn around and see that every child of man becomes a human being only after it has been spoken to. Even the pioneers, of course, had been brought up in a foreign land from the mother, you see, and the father. But this was not, so to speak, made the basis of their investigation, of their thinking. Reciprocal naming, gentlemen, and sensuous conceiving. These are the two roads on which the Logos travels. One into physics of general objects, and one into the city of my own, you have really to add this, of our own members. Where I am a member, you see, of a community, these are my people. You see, this word, this possessive pronoun is totally lacking in the universe. In the universe, nobody owns a farthing. Nobody owns anything. He's just himself an object in this vast universe. So your mind is very troubled, gentlemen, because you start with the universe. Fortunately, our Father in Heaven didn't mean it that way. He says, grow up in a community with brothers and sisters, and mothers and parents, fathers and children. And then you can together go out and look into nature. That's why I've tried to tell you, gentlemen. Nature is the common impression made on the family of men. That's very fortunate. Nature is not the impression the world makes on you alone, you see. But you are only an ear and an eye for all men living together as a family of nations, or as a family of men, or as a human family, or in our town, or however you call it. This inner world in which we can talk to each other. The inner order of life, gentlemen, means that we speak to each other. And fortunately, we, every one of us is inside. And after we have spoken to each other, we are strong enough to arm against the universe and the sea of plagues, and to look out of the window of this community and observe the facts of nature. Oh, bold gentlemen, they are all common observations of any man who uses his reason. They are valid for all men. That's the essence of natural science, is it not? So, gentlemen, in politics, everybody is placed in a different position. In nature, everybody is placed in the same position. Natural facts are facts that appear to everybody alike. Political facts, or ethical facts, or moral facts, or historical facts, or however you call these facts, are facts that appear to everybody differently. That's the result of these two roads on which we travel. The Logos, gentlemen, gives you the power to have a different point of view on everything human, and to have an identical point of view on everything world. What electricity is, we can all agree on, you see. But what Mr. Nixon is, nobody can agree totally with anybody else, you see. That goes from vice president to SOB. And we never agree. If you could only see this, the tremendous act of liberation that should befall you, gentlemen, that these two realities can be now labeled the inner world and the outer world. Nature is the outer world in which everything appears alike to everybody inside the community of men. And the secrets of the inner society are those experiences, gentlemen, which must strike every living member differently, because he, as a member, he holds a different position in this community. It is not obvious, gentlemen, that if that my ear and my toe, as members of my body, receive the same impression in a different manner. Is that right? And that cannot be changed. And obviously, you and I react to the news from the outside world differently than Mr. Douglas. You might see that you're in a different position in this body politics. But you don't see this. You still have the same terrible idea that in political life, we all also should see everything identical. There would be no life there. We would not form a real body of men. The real body politic, gentlemen, allows everybody to have a different reaction. That's so wonderful about real life, gentlemen, that your child has a very different response to the same event as you have. Don't ask it to have the same reaction. So, yeah, please.
That's the base of all Plato's heresies, and you want to have it.
That's where he falls down, you see. Because now comes the Greek one-sidedness. With Heraclitus had insisted on this very fact. He had said time and again that the Logos appeared to everyone in the opposite manner. One would swim up the river and the other would swim down the river. The meaning, however, was the double movement and not the single movement, for example. He would always say, you see, that all opposites only are the way in which we respond to the same universe. Plato has wrestled with Heraclitus, but in the dialogue Cratylus, which is not, unfortunately, in this selection, he deals with Heraclitus and dismisses the whole problem. It's negative, the solution. That's the last dialogue in which we feel a trace of Heraclitus in Plato. Cratylus is a disciple of Heraclitus, and he was so disgusted at the end with the world that he would only nod his head and move his little finger, because he said everything is misunderstanding. Quite a man. He probably was right. I very often have this feeling here at Dartmouth College. And I shall leave you, gentlemen, after this term, this year, with a firm conviction that it has made no difference that I've been here or not. That the misunderstandings are just as numerous as the understanding. And so the equation is zero. Cratylus is right. Today, the basis of understanding is lost because you do not expect understanding in the city of man. You live in nature. And nature, boys, gentlemen, cannot be spoken to. You want to have definitions. You get what you want. Anybody gets what he wants because he will not accept anything else. Gentlemen, you cannot give anything to anybody who doesn't want it. And since you do not expect living truth, but only dead truth, you get dead truth. This cannot be. That has been my fate here for 20 years in this college. Most of you expect, gentlemen, facts, you expect objects, you expect definitions, you expect something to learn by heart, you expect assignments to read 3 pages a day, and that you think is intellect and mental life. You end up with these mechanized examinations with yes and no. Well, gentlemen, that's good for donkeys and for horses. It is not good for men. I mean, you remain on the level of a trained animal. Because the world of objects is for trained animals, because man is there alone with the world of objects. But we live, the higher order of life, gentlemen, is to come to an agreement, although we do not see the same objects. One lives in Colorado and the other lives in China. If we can agree, you see, although all the objects outside are different, you see, then we have the same religion and we believe in the same God. That's the question of mankind. That's the logos. What's the difference? Well, why do you see, you insist that I spoke to a student, and you know this story, it's always repeated. I must marry young, he said, because I want to play football with my son. That's not a good reason to get married. He wants to have the same object, the same ball in the hands of his boy. He has given up all hopes that he might give him the same religion. You see, an agreement, despite the differences of age, of objects, of natural environment, that would be a father. He only wants to be his boy's playboy, playmate. That's a very poor logic. But that's today the best a boy will think of his son, somebody to play with, on equal terms. That's the natural world, where the ball is everything. Carry the ball. But speech means agreement at the heart, and at bottom also the scene daily changes. And in a changing scene, one in Europe and the other in America and the third in Russia and the fourth in Africa, they are to be of the same faith and the same love and the same ethics. That's something. That's difficult. And your forefathers did it. They remain Christians in this foreign country. And if there is a greatness in America at this moment, it is that it is the one country in which the other countries find some eternity, you see, some eternal thing still. But don't throw it away, gentlemen. Don't get lost in objects. Don't get lost in concepts. Gentlemen, the Logos appears in Plato in great models, because the one thing that can be expressed through in any language is the name of the hero. And the myth in Plato, for example, plays this part that it brings in some figures like Zeus or the gods to call something superhuman. The Logos can only be imparted to you and me, gentlemen, as superhuman and as supernatural. And there are two roads then to the Logos, the supernatural. That is, it must be not simply objects of nature. Supernatural simply means not an object. Don't be frightened by the word. I don't like it myself, but in this moment it's a useful thing. Supernatural means it consists not of objects which can be explained by concept. And it must be superhuman, gentlemen. You have heard of the many jokes that have been made of about Nietzsche's Superman. Gentlemen, don't laugh it off. Superman is the most natural experience of the Logos. Nietzsche meant simply that a man can be the carrier of enthusiasm, of Logos, of divinity. And so he's a Superman. Of course he is. How can you deny that? And if you all are Superman in all your light moments, better moments, then you summon a criminal to court, you are superhuman, gentlemen, because you are not just a human being, but you know what's right. And you have to say this. It is terrible that this country has fallen, I mean, below Benjamin Franklin even, and his practicality and his utilitarianism, by saying that Superman is funny. Nietzsche was crazy because he spoke of Superman. Gentlemen, anybody who speaks is supernatural and is superhuman. As human beings, we don't have to say anything with authority. That the whole human society is based on authority. Somebody has to say at this moment, this is a crime, and this judge is an authority. And I had to dismiss yesterday a boy for forgery, for plagiarism, and so I was in authority. It was very disagreeable, but there I was, settled with this responsibility, and he will leave college. And I say so, and it is done. And that is superhuman. If you don't see that as a superhuman, you do not understand what is human, you see. As a human, I'm only one of you, you see. But as superhuman, I can put a human being outside the city. I can excommunicate it, you see. And that I do not do in my own right. I do it as bearer of an authority, you see, which is superhuman. It goes through my mouth, the Logos streams through me, but I am not interested in it as a party. I am an office holder. It is my office to do that. President Dickey is only interesting as president of Dartmouth College for us, you see. Not as a personal friend. Not as another human being, you see. But for his superhuman authority. That what he says goes. It is high time for you, gentlemen, to recapture the sense of the divine in the very modest way that you say the divine is first of all not natural, because it is not an object. And it is secondly not human, because it has authority to change the order of things, to change the city, to close the doors, and say, this lies in the capitulate, for example, the men who can surrender a city and say, we merge, like Sam Houston when Texas was made a part of the Union, you see. God spoke through him, and so he couldn't go back on his word. In 1861, the same time, Houston, as you know, resisted in the South as the only man, the governor, in the whole South, he resisted secession. And it will always be a point of my greatest admiration that this old fox and scoundrel and drunkard, that he was divinely enough inspired that he said, I brought Texas into the Union in 1800, when? When?
45.
Yes. And? After 9 years of independence. And now I cannot, 15 years later, say that I secede from the same Union. That's divine, gentlemen, to bear the cross of one's own word and to acknowledge that this word was not said by itself as a whim, as a from a salesman, as an empty promise, but that is what he meant it. That he felt he was in authority to have the Texas, you see, enter the United States. He couldn't go against the divine authorities that had spoken out of him in 1845, and he went to pieces and he perished ignominiously in 1861. But I'm glad to see that there is still a city called Houston in his memory. And this is the relation, gentlemen, to the Logos. You know of the Logos that founded the state of Texas as a part of the Union through the name Houston. And in this sense you have, because without this one name Houston, you see, Texas would have no interest. Texas would just be like it. So, gentlemen, the Logos remains in evidence through the names of the people to whom the Spirit has spoken. Very simple definition, to whom the Logos has spoken. The Logos cannot remain with us through definition. And therefore, gentlemen, the Logos of Greek philosophy speaks to us through the name of Plato. Plato is the Houston, you see, of the Greek realm, which corresponds to Texas here. Can you see this? You have to remember the Plato and Plato's name and life in order to know what the Logos is. Logos, Plato is sacrificed his allegiance to us. Therefore, we don't know him as a member of the city of Athens, but as a member of the academy, that is, as a person who left the city of man and left the natural world and became a representative of the Logos in his own right. What I have tried today, gentlemen, to show you why it is true that even a man like Plato, whom you would tap on the shoulder and say, well, Mr. Plato, one more cup of coffee, that Plato represents in this world of ours that what is not common, because it doesn't belong to nature and it doesn't belong to this community. The word, gentlemen, by which the philosophers have always tried to express this strange situation is transcendence. We had the transcendentalists in Concord, you have heard this word. That is, gentlemen, a man climbs higher than nature and than his own city if he wants to speak through the ages. The Logos is that power which makes a man superhuman and supernatural. And perhaps for the first time in your life it may dawn on you why my division of ethics in physics is still very modern, because you always keep apart superhuman and supernatural. But these are two sides of the triangle on which we move, you see. You must, when you speak with authority, gentlemen, in founding the United States, in writing the Declaration of Independence, these founders, these signers, we are inspired. They said something for the first time, so they were not in agreement with anybody of an existing city. The British wrote them. And it was natural what they said, you could see this. And therefore, I plead with you, gentlemen, you are such modest men and such kind people that you say, I'm just a human being. And so you decline to admit that a man ever is superhuman. It's just quite silly. And also, if I say something is supernatural, it strikes you as even more silly. You say, I'm just natural. Gentlemen, by saying I'm just natural, you are supernatural. And by saying I'm just a human being, you are superhuman. It is not a part of a human being to say I'm just a human being. The little word just is the humility of the God in your heart, of the divine. And if you would only discover that you all plead to be vessels of the divinity by saying just, these four little letters, G, U, S, T, are a great arrogance, because it means you know. It means that you can judge your own place in life. Who can this? Does the elephant know, you see? Most people don't know. You can, but that is superhuman and that's supernatural. If a man in the community only wants to keep up with the Joneses, he gets his judgment from everybody else. He doesn't say, I'm just a human being. If I judge the people in the Easter parade on 5th Avenue, right, you see, they want to be seen as one of the crowd, as one of the gang. They don't want to be told, I'm just a human being. They want to be told that they had the best diamond necklace on the whole street. They want to be seen for what they are worth, and that they are on the social register, and that they are pious people and whatnot. And therefore, gentlemen, human beings add tremendously to their stature when they say, I am just a human being. That's much more than the usual human being wants to be told. The usual human being wants to say, I can may become President of the United States. That's a human being. Or I want to, you see, I shall have an income of $1 million a year, whatever your ambition is. That you are as just as a human being. But to say I'm just a human being, that means to sit on a throne on which, from which you can authoritatively look down on your own humanity and on your own nature. You see, and you all do it. And therefore you all believe in some kind of divinity or devil. Whatever it is, certainly in something higher than yourself. There's a mere self. As self, gentlemen, and as member of, as an American, you are on the level of humanity and nature. As speakers and judges, you're always sharing God's authority, the Logos. Sorry, but this is, after all, as you see, very important. Now, I have, allow me, I didn't make an have an intermission, and I'm sorry for this, I intended to. Will you allow me simply to carry through? Perhaps you get up for a minute and sit down again, if you stretch your legs. We, as the historians of Greek philosophy, we have a great privilege. Plato had to speak of physis, he had to speak of ethics, of the city in general, and he had to speak of the philosopher. We are privileged to be specific. And I say to you, we have been talking of Athens, of Plato, and of the universe. That is, we have replaced the abstract philosopher, gentlemen, by the name of Plato, by which we can talk to him, and he can talk to us. And we have replaced the word polis or town by Athens for his Greek word. Here we should, of course, write the word pan, the all, the whole, the word universe, being the Latin word. And those who write on Stoicism, as Mr. Pitzner, where is he? Yeah, know that they are pantheists because they worship the pan as God, you see, the universe. In the word pantheism, you see, the pan is the God. Pan is the Greek word for universe, and that's important for you to introduce this word pan, perhaps, into your vocabulary. Well, gentlemen, by a stroke of genius, Plato himself has solved the quandary between the city and Plato. There is a quandary, because Plato is the Logos.
The city is that part of the Logos in which people speak to each other. The universe is that part of the reality, you see, of the universe in which we speak about things, where they don't talk back. You understand that then Plato is Logos, the city is Ethos, and the Pan is Physis. Now Plato, in his modesty and humility, and in his wish to impart the best city to all other men, and to make him, Plato, you see, only the first good citizen of the best state, by talking other people, so to speak, by persuading them into it, you see, by his eloquence. Plato had a very profound insight, which is today still used and is with us, and it is the greatest, so to speak, heritage or legacy of Plato to us. He said, the city of men is organized like the human being, and the human being is organized like the city. If so, he could say Plato is a city and Athens is Plato. And how did he do it? He said, the city and Plato consist of mind, heart, and stomach. And the city of men, therefore, must also consist of mind, heart, and stomach. And there he obliterated the distinctions between the Logos and the Ethos, between Plato and the city. It is very dangerous, gentlemen, to say that the city is simply nothing but men written large. But that's what Plato and later Aristotle did. Plato said, the mind or the head. He said in the Timaeus, the head. In the Republic, he said, the mind. There's two terms for it. The heart, in the Republic, no, here, pardon me, in Timaeus, the heart, here the courage. This was the reason. See? And in the Republic, he says the passions, and in the Timaeus, he says the belly. Ah, in you and me, we all must eat. These are the liver and the bladder and the genitals. These are the passions. We must feel. We must have courage. Take courage. We must breathe. That is the region between the neck and the diaphragm, the lungs and the heart. And we must think, that's the head. And as you know, all Greek philosophy thinks that the head should be master of the heart and the passions. I think it's a very wrong philosophy, but all Greek philosophy has the idea that the mind is the head because it is up here, is superior to the heart. Now, the Duchess of Windsor, as you know, doesn't think so. And I don't think so, and no Christian can think so. Gentlemen, the error of Greek philosophy is to think that because the high heavens are up and the sky is up and the head is the highest, that's why the head must be better than the heart. If you, however, analyze your own existence a little bit more carefully, you will understand why our brain and the cells of our brain are the roots of the matter. We are rooted in the sky, so it is as though we were standing on our head, so to speak. We are not standing on our feet mentally, intellectually, and in our existence as being, but we are hanging through our reason in an earth, in a soil, because here is the nourishment which we receive, you see, in these brain cells. But we are free with our limbs and our whole body to go into the world and create something new. And therefore, it is very dangerous to use the Greek idea that the head is higher, as high as heaven over the earth, and therefore better. That's the Greek idea, however. And now look what it did. The equation of the individual in the Republic and in the Timaeus. The individual's three great qualities. with the qualities any good city should have, enabled Plato to disappear behind the city and to say the philosopher is nothing but the small edition of the city. And therefore, as you know, he organized the city with the head on top, with the heart in the middle, and with the passions below. That is, he said, there must be always three parties, as in India today in the caste system. There must be the priests, that are the philosophers, there must be the warriors, you see, who have the courage, and there must be the craftsmen, the peasants, and the artisans, who take care of the passions, of the skills of the body, of the merely physical talents and endowments of our physical nature. Now, this is then the most deep-seated legacy of the Greek political mind and the Greek natural mind, that the individual is built as the city, and the city is built as the individual. I would say that even in the tripartition of the judiciary, the executive and the legislative branch of the government, you probably still have a reminder of the three things. The executive, the military, is for courage, you see. The legislation is for the economic interests, and the judiciary is for the reason, for the just, for justice. And though you have still in Montesquieu and in our constitution an echo of Plato's idea of government having to follow the lines of our individual human endowment. The individual for Plato is consisting of head, heart, and belly. And therefore the state must organize in such a way that on top are the guardians, on top is reason. Then comes the soldiers, and below come the farmers and artisans, and the people who deal with the material world. This is the thing that later already by Aristotle was a little transmuted. Who is it who works on Aristotle? Well, what's his theory, my dear man? He does not follow Plato so simply, but he says that the great empires, the Egyptians and the Persians, they cultivate the skills in their temple building, in their medicines, and in their craft, and all their arts, and they deserve the belly, because the individual is not free there, but it works as a Hindu, craftsman would work today. And then the tribesmen of the north, they are the courageous people, they are warriors. You have warriors at Aristotle. And he said the great compromises between the two. He puts, as he always does this in Happy Mean, Aristotle puts the Greeks in the middle of the story. Now, this, however, in Plato is not the case. In Plato, the wild tribes are the courageous people. The great empires are the belly people, and the Greeks are the head people, the reasonable people. The people who think, who can, so to speak, tower above the passions and above the generosity, the movements of the heart, the courage, generosity, what else would you say is business of the heart, the faith, loyalty, all these emotions of the nobler nature. But I think the exciting thing is that now for 2,000 years, gentlemen, every human being in the West has believed in this authority of Plato with regard to politics. That's quite a story. And there you, I thought I should tell you this, whether you read Plato yourself or not, you live in a constitution that is Platonized, that in a certain manner has tried to make us believe that head, heart, and belly must be organized in a city in three layers. The government must be reasonable, you see. The economic interests must follow passionately their self-interest, you see, and you must have an army that's courageous. And we haven't changed that much. You can only see this, you see. The secular society of today is still thought of very much in the Platonic pattern.
on the monuments or for the people at the top of the government to find out the logos, they can see the tools and do it?
Wait, you all right?
Yeah, well, I'm going to say Plato is the logo.
Well, since he tries to persuade other people to found the city and to make the philosopher king, therefore Plato, if he is the head of the city, he himself is the best man, is he not? Then he represents the logos in the city.
Why does he represent
it? You see, because the logos is connected with the city through him. That is, through Plato, the logos would enter the next city, and it would therefore be the best. He couldn't get out of his quandary. We all want, of course, to have children of our own stirring. And I have no objections against this, you see, that the man should be the model. And I think he was a very noble son and generous soul. Well, heaven forbid that I would belittle this. I only don't believe that the city of men can ever be governed, you see, by the logos. And we talked about this before, why that should be. Because you have to wait till the last child can agree. And that's not the business of the logos, but of service of the public. I mean, it takes quite a different character to be patient with people, you see. A philosopher doesn't have to be patient with people, he has to think the truth. That's a different quality. But I think this is a very great scheme, which is, has then been carried over into all forms. The secret is, gentlemen, if you have ethos, you have a community. If you have physics, you have millions of objects, what you call nature. And you already really say more than you can prove that this is one word. You can also, the Hindus say there are many words. Plato had already the idea of one universe because to all members of one community, we can talk sense about the universe through mathematics. That was a great dream, that nature was general, the same to all. Not to the Hindus, that's not true, but to the Greek and world. One universe for the citizens of the human family. Now the logos is, so to speak, saved in the Platonic philosophy by saying that the qualities of the individual perfect man are the same as the qualities of the perfect citizen. But I don't think we have any reason to believe that. I mean, I do not see this identity that because I have a head and a belly and a heart, I have to believe that the city of man must have a head and a belly and a heart. I mean, the government of a city may be based on quite different principles. If I want to compromise between citizens, you have to be proved to me that I myself as a compromise between the two have to consist of the part of the citizens that I think that's very hard. So I have never been struck by the truth of this thing, but by the genius which through this identification, gentlemen, you get the power of philosophy over the city. Only if the individual philosopher has in himself the same aura as the city, can he claim authority to rule the city. Oh, that was Plato's discovery, or saving grace. Seeing the city going to ruin, he said, the best man is the model for the city. The city is men who are large, man is the city who is small. Therefore, gentlemen, you should never use the word for the great philosopher to all agree that man is a microcosm. That's a very silly word that should be buried. Man is the necropolis. He is the small city. And the forest is the macroanthropos. The city of man is man with large macroanthropos. And man is the micropolis. He is the city of man with small. But he is not a microcosmos. That's, some other philosophers have believed this. But that is not true of the bulk of great philosophy. The real great philosophy is a little more profound. It says, man is the city written small, and the city is man written large.
Please keep this. It's a very important thing. To most people, one cannot talk to them because they take these slogans like microcosm, and they have never thought it through what it could mean. Since we do not know the principles which join the world, the cosmos, it is nothing to say that you say man is a microcosm. You would have to know the cosmos a little better for this. Today it would boil down to the fact that we have some electrons inside ourselves, and the cosmos has some electrons inside ourselves. You will admit that this doesn't make us into a microcosm. Because do we function like the whole cosmos? But the city is a different story. If you say you function like the United States of America, and the United States of America functions as you, you can talk, you see, back and forth. So, let's stop here.